welcome to Dig in the Dirt. I'm Ann Goldine, and this week we're going to talk about ivy. The Oregon Department of Agriculture has labeled ivy as one of the top invasive species in Oregon, and as of June, it is illegal to, or it will be illegal to sell it. My guest today is Glenn Ahrens. He is the OSU Faculty Extension in Forestry, and that might seem like an odd thing because ivy's horticulture, but it certainly impacts our forests. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Ann.
Okay, so you have taken an interest in ivy, and in fact, one of the things that we talked about last time you were here was that a lot of trees in the 2007 storm that blew down wouldn't have blown down if they didn't have ivy on them.
Yeah, that's right. Particularly the deciduous trees, red alder, our most prominent one.
Mm-hmm.
The ivy is evergreen and gets light around the edges of the growing season on the alders, and it also is up in the air with a large canopy that could help the tree blow down, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And it also just leads to early decline of alder, which is already a short-lived tree.
Uh-huh. So then they died earlier. Okay, so so what's been leading this pack? I mean, a lot of people in other parts, like in Portland, have been on the ivy rampage for years, especially in Forest Park.
That's right. Yeah, about 5,000 acres, one of the biggest forest parks in the country. And the ivy coming into that park around the edges and in the middle now, I think they mobilized, I think about 10 years ago, really started working hard on that. But we have the same problem in most of our towns now in Oregon and throughout the Northwest with ivy escaping. And it particularly ends up in the forest and climbing trees. And it brings foresters into this mix a little bit more. It's one of the few invasives that really will thrive and grow underneath a dense forest canopy. Foresters usually think we can restore native forests pretty quickly and win the war against many of the noxious weeds because many of them do not thrive underneath a native forest. But ivy is one of those tough ones that does.
Right. Well, and we've certainly seen along the highways ivy pulling down alders. I don't know about maple so much, but certainly alders.
Well, and particularly with the deciduous trees losing their leaves, ivy's climbing all the different trees, conifers or deciduous trees, but the deciduous trees are generally shorter, maybe not as strong, and alder in particular, maple though, also will hold an awful lot of ivy, but it is a stronger, bigger, longer-lived tree than alder.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one of the things that surprised me was let's say, you know, there's a tree that has it and I'm taking it off. Okay, so I'm gonna cut that ivy at the base. And maybe it's an inch and a half in diameter, that stem. So I cut it and I think, okay, now I'm going to pull it off. I can't pull it off. Those roots all the way up that tree are so embedded, they have become one with the tree, you can't get it off.
Yeah, and we normally don't even try once it gets big, and they can get up to several inches in diameter. I think we have some very old ivy vines around here that are 3 inches in diameter. The usual approach is to cut it near the bottom, near ground level, and also a couple of feet higher and cut out a whole section. You may need a little pry bar to stick in between the ivy vine and the tree trunk, and you want to be careful not to damage the tree itself. Using a handsaw, and you have to cut a section of the ivy vine all around the tree, and then you just leave it there to die, and the rest up above in the crown it dies, and then the rest of the work is all on the ground, which will require an awful lot of digging and pulling, unless you were going to use chemicals, for instance.
So that is an option?
It is. Some of the worst situations and in certain areas, depending on the landowner and their goals and what they find acceptable, there are some chemical herbicide control options. The No Ivy League in Portland has really led the way, among others in Oregon, focused on, you know, the ivy in Forest Park. And they have tested some chemical methods and found one kind of fairly recent discovery is that in the winter using certain herbicides when the ivy is still there, evergreen.
Right, everything else is pretty dormant.
Everything else is gone, so that's a way to minimize harm to other plants that you don't want to hurt. And that's been found to be pretty effective as far as getting the ivy and killing it. But I think by far the more common methods are still the mechanical and a lot of volunteer effort mm-hmm. to get out and cut it and pull it and dig it and then pile it and dispose of it and try to favor native plants. But it's going to be a long-term process. Not all going to be done in 1 year, but the first year really gets a chunk of the ivy removed.
Now, what about like a hillside and it's coming up the hillside or it's going down the hillside and you've got a steep canyon to deal with and the ivy doesn't care, it just goes. It'll run for 50, 100 feet.
That's true. I guess one benefit of that is that we can use gravity in our favor. One of the methods is basically rolling the ivy into a mat. So if you start at the top of a hill and you chop a line along the contour, mm-hmm. and then you just start pulling that mat of ivy vines down and you roll it up like a, just like a bundle, just rolling it down the hill and just keep cutting and rolling this big mat of ivy and then cut it off at the bottom as well and do it in chunks. So the gravity on the steep slope could help you in that fashion, although you may still need a little help to keep the humans from rolling to the bottom of the hill.
Right. Well, okay, now I've got a place where I have a big cliff where it's coming up and creeping along, and it's hard to get down in the steep part to get it, and it's also hard to pull it out of the ground. It's a very adherent plant. I'm standing at the top, and I want to get it out of the ground, so at least it's not putting out new roots. It's difficult. Is there a trick there? You need a shovel?
Well, I think a various combination of tools, and that's one of the things that all the volunteer groups learn is they come up with their own different sets of tools, and it mm-hmm. depends on just how well entrenched the ivy is and how big they are. Some of my earliest memories in doing yard work, working my way through college, was being turned loose on getting the ivy out, and it all depends on the size. But you might need bigger pry bars, metal bars, heavier cutting tools. Usually, a pair of loppers and maybe a mattock or a big heavy hoe might be enough. But when those vines are an inch or two thick, then you might start needing, heavier tools.
A saw. Yeah, I'm not sure.
We have sacrificial saws sometimes, or we just know they're going to get dulled in the dirt, and we just go to work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So one of the common places where ivy comes from, or has in the past, has been from inside plant arrangements that will have ivy as part of some kind of a plant thing. And I don't know what people do with it, but they must plant it when they're done with having it in the house.
Yeah, the source of our ivy, of course, it started as a very popular horticultural plant, and we love the ivy on the buildings and in ornamental arrangements and such. But of course, now we've learned how destructive it is. And one of the main sources is continuing distribution of ornamental ivies. There's hundreds of cultivars, of hybrids or genetic cultivars from English ivy that are in the home or around the landscape, and then they might escape. And that's one of the reasons that we're increasingly kind of discouraging that, and this current ban on English ivy, which I think refers to the main English ivy. So you'll still, I think, be able to get some of the special ornamental varieties that are supposedly not so invasive. But as a general rule, we're saying be very careful with ivies, and maybe the safest place is a hanging basket and not even getting it out on the ground anywhere in the landscape, because then it ultimately gets spread at the edges of our yards, or gets spread by dumping yard debris out over the bank or that kind of a thing. So maybe the safest thing is in a hanging basket, and then if it declines, then burn it when you're done.
Not put it in the compost, not throw it over the bank.
Yeah, and in terms of disposal, we are looking at kind of practical realities here. So making a large pile or cutting and scattering pieces and trying to ensure that they dry is often the case. We can't necessarily fill the many truckloads and haul it off site, and then where's it going to go? It's the place where it tends to go is the landfill, and it can be ground up in the recycling side of that and composted, which is probably relatively safe, but there's also a possibility of it being spread that way if it's not fully composted.
Okay, what about the person's yard who has an ivy blanket as a ground cover? And maybe this is a quarter of an acre or, you know, a whole section of their yard. Instead of lawn, they have ivy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, it's not illegal to have that.
No, it's not. And the recent law is just showing that we're increasingly recognizing the problem, but we're not necessarily going to patrol the neighborhood and say
you'd have to dig that up and try something else.
We're really just trying to contain it and stop it from being spread more. My yard has some patches of ivy in it. The house I grew up in has a 60-year-old patch of ivy, and we just keep it trimmed at the edges and keep it contained. And I wouldn't tell my mother she should kill her ivy. but we are going to be more careful with how it gets transported and moved around.
Okay, now one of the ways that it gets transported is when it goes to seed and really becomes a different kind of a plant, and then the birds eat the seeds. The birds in the fall seem to love ivy seeds, and then there's seeds everywhere, and then you have seedlings. And those are really easy to pull out because they're little babies, just one little teeny little branch like your little finger, and you pull that out and you're done. But you have to pay attention in the fall when those start sprouting or even over the winter.
That's right. We must be on the lookout for them. And that reminds me, for those in the audience that aren't entirely familiar and steeped in ivy lore, as you and I seem to be, Anne, we have some good fact sheets explain the life cycle and the characteristics of ivy and the basic control methods. And one of them that I use, kind of focused on the forest, is an extension forestry fact sheet on ivy. The website for the No Ivy League, if you just type that in and look, they have probably the best sources of information and links out to other information. The Nature Conservancy, just about any of your local groups here that are active in land management and restoration.
Mm-hmm.
But that is an interesting characteristic of ivy, that it has what we call a dimorphic habit, in that it's a ground crawling thing in the shade, and when it gets out into the open sun, it makes a more of a fruiting form that has leaves that are differently shaped. They're more of a simple leaf instead of the lobed leaf that you're used to seeing on the ground, and out come the flowers and the berries, and the birds pick up those berries, and they also fall to the ground and sprout underneath the trees.
Now, there's no effort in this Department of Agriculture ruling that makes people prevent that. I mean, that is so preventable, right? A stem starts to go up, you lop it off. There's nothing stopping that. So that whole method of propagation is going to continue.
It will. And of course, one of the reasons, you know, we're talking about it now is to increase awareness. And if you do have ground ivy, at least keep it on the ground, keep it contained at the edges, and don't let it grow up and flower. And if you see signs of it doing that, as you said, lop it off. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the primary reasons that the tree arboreal ivy, climbing ivy, is such a problem, because it gets up in the tree and then it has lots of sun and it flowers, and then it has a good perch to spread the seed from, and for the birds to do the same.
I mean, it's obviously an adaptation that ivy has developed to keep itself going as a species.
It certainly seems well adapted to.
It's very successful. Okay, let's take a break. Kate Brister is here. If you have any questions for the Master Gardener on the hotline, give a call here at 503-325-0010. My guest is Glenn Ahrens. He is the OSU faculty in forestry. And you're listening to Digging the Dirt, and we'll be right back. Back. You're listening to Digging the Dirt. I'm Ann Goldin, and I'm with Glenn Ahrens, the OSU Faculty Extension in Forestry, and we're talking about ivy. So there are some events coming up.
That's right, and I hope we caused a lot of unscheduled events with people paying more attention to the ivy.
Unscheduled events, I like that.
And doing some work in the yard on all the other things they've got to do, add ivy to your list. You can generally look for your local organizations, such as, again, the Extension Office in either Clatsop and Tillamook County. I definitely want people to call their extension office here in Astoria at 325-8573. If you happen to be interested in contributing your effort, get on our list as a potential weed warrior, so to speak, so that when we do schedule IV control projects, we can call you and try to recruit you. And so that's one perhaps unscheduled event. If people get on a list, we'll schedule one. I am looking at trying to do one here in Astoria, particularly up on the hill here where so many of the alder came down, and the ivy is such a problem at the edges of Astoria. You may have this near you wherever you live. But here I'm looking at the middle school perhaps as a good place to focus.
Oh, that is a great idea. That place is just full of ivy, the whole forest all around the school.
That's right, and that gives us, between the middle school, the city of Astoria, and Clatsop County, there's ownership up on the hill and going back into the woods where we have a lot of invasive ivy. All of those entities are very interested in doing more. The city and the county have plans and will probably do much more organized and just, you know, paid work to get noxious weeds removed, including ivy. But I'm thinking of this day at the middle school because they had a couple acres of blowdown that was replanted, and there's ivy all through that. And I haven't quite got that set yet, but I'm looking at perhaps mid-May for that. And so listen for an announcement on that if we can get that coordinated.
Great. And how many people do you think would be good to have on that day?
Well, I'm kind of curious how many people are that interested. I'm thinking of it on a Saturday, and if I can get four or five crew leaders such as myself, and then get volunteers and bring your loppers and your saws and other things. But I think the more the better, within limits. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't expect to see more than 20 or 30 at the most. Mm-hmm. Another event coming up that is scheduled is Saturday, June 19th. My colleague, Rob Emanuel, who you may know as Rob River on KMUN Radio, he is taking a lead in invasive species control in both Clatsop and Tillamook County, and he's coordinated a workshop we call the Invasive Species Early Detection Network. It's going to focus on weed identification and reporting, trying to get the new ones before they become a problem, such as English ivy is now. And that's going to be June 19th, Saturday, at the Fort Clatsop Natal Room. And so if you're interested in that, also call the extension office. Mm-hmm. I do encourage you to look out at the Portland No Ivy League, some of the other websites, and you'll see events scheduled in various communities. I'm thinking of working with Oregon Solve, which is a great coordinator, you know, a hub for doing some of these restoration projects. Of course, we know them for the beach cleanup and a lot of other things, but they help local entities organize volunteer days, and they help with some of the signups and the waivers and liability issues as well. So I'd like to work with them more.
That sounds great.
There's another one coming up in Warrenton in June.
Correct. June 26th from 9 to noon, there'll be an ivy pull. It's coordinated by the North Coast Land Conservancy, that you meet at Warrenton High School, and they'll be doing the pull along the Skippinon River. So that's another resource that they're doing. You know, they're involved with a whole bunch of efforts. In fact, you can go to their website and see a lot of events that are going on there to learn things, to get involved with things. I've tried to get people interested in ivy for years through the radio, and I haven't ever been able to organize anything. So I'm really glad to see that people want to get something happening now. I think it's reached a critical point when people saw all those trees go down in 07 and went, what can we do to prevent that? Those were preventable losses of trees.
Some of those were. I mean, mm-hmm. We certainly, it was bad enough out in the hemlock and some of the denser conifer forests that blew down, and there was nothing you could do about it. When you have a big crown of ivy in an alder, that's something that you could prevent.
Right, we could have prevented that. And so I think, I mean, I suppose in a way, we all bear some of the responsibility. City, county, private landowners, and us citizens, all.
Well, and I think it's reaching a point now, as time has gone by, this problem has developed over the last 50 years or more, and unfortunately, many of those alder out there are nearing, you know, the end of their vigorous life, and they will be going into their later declining period, and alders may start falling over as early as 50 to 60 years. They can live up towards 100. And so the difference in how much time we have before more of the alders are declining, falling down, may depend on some things we can do as a, you know, something to improve their lifespan from here. But it is something to think about in that we have many older alder, many with ivy that we're going to have to deal with over time, and we should start working at it so it doesn't hit us all at once.
But, you know, on the other hand, there should be lots of baby alders. I mean, I have alders sprouting in my yard every year, and if I don't get on top of it, I've got a pretty substantial tree within 2 or 3 years. And so there should be babies coming up. Of course, we don't want ivy on them either.
Well, and that the should be part. Now, that gets down to a value judgment. Do we necessarily want more alders?
Okay.
We have alders, and they're fine trees, but of course, now they're becoming large and perhaps somewhat hazardous at the edge of development. So the question about what should grow next really is you know, it may be alder coming up, but is that what you want? That's something to think about. Of course, as most of us in this area with the wind that we have, are probably increasingly concerned about tall trees of any species too close to homes or structures.
Absolutely.
But if you're choosing to have a tall tree, which ones are the most stable and wind firm? But, you know, back to the ivy question, whatever is coming up, it's going to have to fight it out with the ivy unless we do something to reduce the ivy and control it.
Well, it seems like whatever you plant, you want to keep ivy off it, period.
That's right.
I mean, So, you just said something that makes me, I have to ask you. So what do you think is the best tree to resist high wind?
We looked at that a lot. The Western Red Cedar has some of the best, kind of the highly tapered stem, a stout, strong
base
form, and it does seem to be fairly resistant to high wind. Of course, not every site is suitable for a cedar, and it is a large tree, but it is among those that have a fairly natural, stable form growing up in the wind.
Okay, we had two calls of people who were concerned about herbicides getting in water. Do people know what's getting in water? There's definitely concerns about that aspect. Can people find out if herbicides have been sprayed and like near the watershed?
Yeah, they can certainly find out. And I guess the least regulated use of herbicides is the private use, home use in landscapes. So that part is hard to find out about. It's really just seeing what's going on, and we hope that everybody obeys the laws and the labels and applies those chemicals properly in the home environment. All of the public land applications and the larger private applications of herbicides are going to be documented and are tracked and are, you know, going according to the labels. As far as in noxious weed control, that is one of the challenges because even many groups that would normally not be using herbicides may choose to when they're up against a very difficult weed control problem. And so you see that with Japanese knotweed, with English ivy, and those examples. You know, a lot of conservation and restoration groups are resorting to using herbicides. Now, those uses will be quite well documented as well, and they're going to be
so. Where do you, if you wanted to know about where to find them, where would you look?
Well, as far as finding out what's going on, there is a pesticide use reporting system in Oregon, but it's really been kind of up and down in terms of how it's funded or whether it's active or not. And strictly speaking, all commercial applications and applications, you know, under permits, such as in forestry, any forestry application is registered and logged through the Department of Forestry. But it is a good question as to what we're, you know, what's going to get in the water from all of our uses. And the most challenging part is the home residential use that's not very well monitored.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know it's very difficult to have that conversation with your neighbor when they've either hired or they're out there with their backpack of their stuff and they're spraying it. And I may feel very uncomfortable inside, but I may not be able to say anything.
Well, I could make the point, though, that in the noxious weed control and these ivy poles. That is one place where if we have people who are dedicated to working hard to remove those weeds and to follow up, that's where mechanical, non-chemical methods can be most successful in that you've got a lot of people willing to work hard and be diligent and to have the follow-up. It gets more difficult in the larger landscape, the wildlands, where we don't have a lot of money. We have many, many acres to manage. And in industrial forestry or agriculture, you'll tend to see more chemical use. And they don't have an option because of the costs and such and for their commercial scale. So we actually have more options with more manpower and women power on the ground with noxious weed control with community effort.
I think it's a great idea. So there are lots of ways to plug in, it looks like, coming up to deal with ivy. And I suppose the first one is in your own yard. You know, what can I do at my place to reduce the amount of ivy? I've certainly, when we bought our property, there was ivy on all the trees. And before we even bought it, I started pulling it off. I just thought, we don't need that. That's another level of difficulty. But it's been hard with the bank, the steep bank, to keep it. You know, I'm out there all the time pulling it up.
And there's a trade-off there. A lot of people like ivy stabilizing a bank. Because it does, once it's there, it is holding the bank together. So it reminds me that an important point to think about with ivy control or any weed control is you go to all this trouble to remove something, you leave a lot of bare ground. There's potential for erosion. There's potential for weeds to come back, maybe new weeds. And so
and sliding.
The long-term strategy of having something in mind to replace that noxious weed and that ivy with something that's likely to be you know, the right thing on that site, it's likely to serve whatever goal you have, such as stabilizing a bank or being an attractive ground cover. So the next step is finding what are those species that are good to replace the ivy or other weeds with. And we have some choices there, but that's kind of a new field for us to work harder on that longer-term strategy. We tend to focus on killing or controlling the problem, and the longer-term solution is what comes next. In my case, I'm always interested in native trees and shrubs out in wildlands, but in the home landscape, we have a broader set of choices. There are many choices here. I gave you a handout from Linda McMahon, a veteran master gardener and agriculture extension faculty for OSU, and she lists a few possible choices for replacing ivy.
Oh, good. Okay. Tell.
Actually, you have it in front of you.
Which one is it? Is it this one?
Yes, it is.
All right. Let's see. We have.
And while you're looking for that, we really don't have a long list of those, and that's the next thing for us all to work on in horticulture and the garden community is to find what are the best things to replace these weeds with in different specific situations.
Okay, well, God, she lists some things. Crinkle leaf creeper, Rubus pentalobus, also known as something else, Rubus. Let's see, an evergreen ground cover. Oh, Knickknack. Uva ursi, and climbing hydrangea. Can climb to 60 feet, but doesn't jump the fence.
Well, I know in my yard that...
Those look like the three main ones she lists.
If I keep the ivy back, many of the native shrubs, such as salal or other native shrubs, will take over the space quite well.
And that's a great plant. Thank you very much, Glenn. My guest has been Glenn Ahrens. He's the OSU Faculty Extension in Forestry, and we've been talking about ivy. I'm Ann Goldine.